Hey, my name's Jamie Poisson, and I'm the host of Front Burner. It's the CBC's daily news podcast. And every day, we're discussing the big events and fault lines shaping Canada and the world. Politics, economics, social movements, you name it. Sometimes we even talk about really fun stuff, like the enduring relevance of Lord of the Rings. You can hear Front Burner on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Eleanor Wachtel, and this is Writers and Company from the Archives. Today, from Ireland and the U.S., Colm Tobin. The author of Brooklyn, Nora Webster, The Master and the Magician, talks about his 2006 book of stories, Mothers and Sons. I first came across the work of Colm Tobin when I was doing a special series on Ireland 30 years ago. At the time, he was one of the country's best-known journalists and the author of a couple of novels. I soon came to watch out for his byline, for his thoughtful essays and pocket biographies, such as his 2002 nonfiction book, Love in a Dark Time, Gay Lives from Wild to Almodovar. Tobin didn't include Henry James in this company, but he did mull over his character in the introduction, and then devoted his next novel to an imaginative recreation of 5 years in the life of Henry James. The Master was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and it went on to win the largest cash award for a single novel, the €100,000 2006 International Dublin Literary Award. And I've been following Tobin's work ever since. He's remarkably talented and prolific, publishing collections of short stories and books of essays. His 2009 novel about migration, Brooklyn, won the Costa Best Novel Award and was made into a popular movie starring Saoirse Ronan. Another novel, his most personal, called Nora Webster, is a masterful portrait of a woman, a recent widow in her mid-40s, and of a society in small-town Ireland in the late 1960s. Colm Tobin was born in Enniskerthy, Ireland in 1955. He studied at University College Dublin and has since taught at many American universities, such as Princeton, Stanford, and now Columbia. His last novel, The Magician, reimagined the life of the Nobel Prize winner Thomas Mann, described as Germany's greatest man of letters since Goethe. It won the UK's 2022 Rathbones Folio Prize. Now Colm Tobin is coming out with a sequel to Brooklyn called Long Island. We've spoken many times over the years, but today I'd like to play you our 2007 conversation about his first collection of short stories, Mothers and Sons. Your new book is called Mothers and Sons, and the stories revolve around that relationship. There's a cliche, I suppose, of the Irish mother as martyr, subservient, hard done by. But the mothers in your book don't necessarily fit that stereotype. What did you want to do with that image?
I think there were two things involved. One is that it isn't like that anymore. I think the great changes, great economic changes, say, in Ireland, have made their way into women's lives, perhaps more obviously or more openly than into other things. In other words, an 80-year-old woman in Ireland could get her hair done twice a week, have her own car, and be very independent and go to the Canary Islands, you know, twice each winter.
I've got the character. She also uses the internet.
Yeah. In other words, that the way of being an old woman in Ireland, I think, has fundamentally changed. And I think she could wear bright colours and be terribly interested in what they might call style. And I was interested in exploring that as an idea as well. No, just to go against the cliche, but it's also just the autobiographical stuff that in my family, certainly my own mother wasn't like that. And I was interested in...
Wasn't like which?
She wasn't in any way a conservative, old-fashioned Irish mother, and her friends weren't like that. So that those sort of women that I was watching and that I just knew casually and well went into their 70s living lives of great wit and interest in the world without being in the church all day or locked into cleaning or cooking.
So it's not the cliche, even when it was a cliche, wasn't really true. It was one of those.
Oh, I think it was.
Oh, it was?
I think if you talked about women's lives in Ireland in the 40s and 50s, you're talking about drudgery, you know, domestic drudgery and powerlessness making its way then in old age into something quite unpleasant.
Did you ever consider writing Fathers and Sons?
it's a very different sort of relationship. And in Ireland, I don't know what it's like here, but in Ireland, fathers and sons can be very silent with each other. That where I'm from, women do all the talking. And Beckett is an almost social realist. You know, that a man in Wexford, where I'm from, could easily just sit around the house all day, never saying anything, being happy and being very good under certain conditions and pressures. But especially with his son, wouldn't know quite what to say to him. It wouldn't mean there'd be open conflict, but there wouldn't be open dialogue either. So I suppose, yes, I could get stories with even more silence, more withholding, more things never being mentioned, more stubborn feelings. But I haven't got there yet.
Do you think that the role of fathers, have fathers changed in Ireland the way mothers have?
No.
No?
No.
Why?
They're still as grumpy as ever, you know.
So the economic changes and the other dynamic aspects of the society?
I think in general, things are easier. You know, in other words, the fact that both parents don't desperately want the children to be mass going, say, you know, wouldn't be a great comment. If a son or daughter stopped going to mass on Sunday, say, that wouldn't be a big issue. And I think also, say, if you were gay, which I am, say, that it wouldn't be such a big deal as it would have been even 20 years ago. In other words, everything is sort of softening. And also, there isn't that terrible fight over music and hair that really preoccupied so many parents in the 60s. Get your hair cut and turn that awful music down. You know, that there is a great tolerance for both music and hair. And that makes for greater domestic bliss and ease because they used those things to have big fights with their children, which the children never really got over, you know.
Now, your own father died when you were only 12, which left your mother with five children to raise on her own. What did that mean for your family?
Well, I suppose we missed him. I mean, he was a sort of wonderful man. And one of the stories, The Name of the Game, deals with that to some extent, although my mother didn't have a shop, but about a woman under those conditions deciding, actually, I'm going to hold everything together. And the only way to do so is financially. In other words, like, I'm going to go out and get a job. And so, you know, it was, I suppose, it was like being Hamlet, except that there was no Claudius. You know, in other words, that Gertrude didn't remarry, but there was a ghost. You know what I mean? And you wandered the earth for a few years wondering what had hit you, putting an antic disposition on, you know. But my mother was terribly good, you know, in that she found a new life for herself and she managed things very well. So some of the stories are about that idea of rebuilding a life and what that's like.
Did your father talk?
He was very bad at having an argument with his children. So he was terribly nice to us all. My mother did all the cross, you know, talk. All the, you know, if there was trouble, it was caused by my mother in the house. My father just tended to laugh and smile. You know.
Tell me a bit more about your mother. What your relationship with her was like?
Well, my mother left school at 14. And she educated herself. And like a lot of people who did that, she was very, very serious about reading. And she knew a lot of Shakespeare, and a lot of Shakespeare off by heart. She would have read a lot of poetry and done all that on her own very, very seriously. And she kept her books away from my father's books because, you know, there were different sorts of readers. My father was more interested in history and fact and politics and my mother in poetry. But as she got older, she became terribly interested in the novel, not the 19th century novel, which she deplored. I mean, she had quite strong views on things, but on novelists like Saul Bellow, Doris Lessing, and she bought novels, or she would buy paperbacks, but she'd go to the library and she'd know everything that was coming out. And she loved especially Saul Bellow. She loved smart American writing. I think she thought my books were a bit slow, but she never said that to me.
Was she pleased that her fourth son had become a writer?
You know, my younger brother was much more successful in many ways in that he was an international bridge player and he was on the Irish team. And he also, you know, worked in Africa with, first of all in Africa for about 10 years and then in Ireland working for agencies that were dealing with famine and problems in Africa. And I think she might have been prouder of him to some extent. But she was easygoing about it, really. I mean, I didn't ever ask her if she was proud. It wouldn't be the word used. But she took an interest in things. You know.
You semi-mockingly referring to yourself as adopting an antique position in, you know, Hamlet-like in relation to the death of your father. But you were 12. You had all these older brothers and sisters, younger brother. What was it like for you?
What happened was that the other three, the three older ones, were away. And my father died in the summer. So that when September came, they went back, you know, to college. And there were just the two of us, my younger brother and myself, there. I was 12 and he was 8 with my mother. So that there was those winters, you know, or those years, those 3 years when there was just the three of us in the house, were very memorable in the sense that we watched her very carefully. And none of us ever discussed what the problems were. And I became interested in writing at that time. And I think my younger brother became very interested in being studious, you know, and both of us just found something to preoccupy us, me by writing poetry, and him, I think, by being really good in school. And but it was a strange household, you know. I mean, in other words, up to then, there were more people in the house. But then once we went back to school, there were just the three of us. And I cooked, from the age of 12, I cooked dinner every day and did everything. You know, I did all the domestic stuff. So I would get out of school early, because dinner was in the middle of the day in Ireland in those years. I got out of school early and I went home on my own, had a key, went in and made the dinner and had everything ready when everyone came in. And then washed up. And
your mother taught you? Your mother taught you?
She was working.
She taught you to cook?
Yeah. It was basic stuff, but yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I don't think she did. I just learned. I mean, someone had to do it.
Did you feel burdened?
No, it was very interesting. I loved solitude at that time. I loved coming into the house on my own. I think I did anyway.
Wait a minute, did you? When you say you think,
yeah,
you
I mean,
did.
Nobody asked me if it was okay, so I just did it.
Well, I was thinking about this loving of solitude because there are characters in your fiction, of course, who are loners and who do seem to really love solitude.
Yeah, yeah. In other words, I think those few years really marked me. And I didn't even know this maybe until I started writing the books, where bits of all that got into all the books in one way or another.
And you're saying that your mother kind of surfaces in your fiction in a certain way. I mean,
yeah, I mean, she was a terribly clever woman and very good storyteller and very. So I haven't really written about her directly in that way. There was a funny episode where herself and a few of her friends missed a flight to some island they were going to for sun in the Irish winter, and I was launching a friend's book, so I invited them to come to the party, which was a sort of mistake. You should never allow people to meet your family. You don't need to meet them. And so this woman, I mean, she's a friend of mine, Caroline Walsh, and she's very nice, and she works for the Irish Times, and I introduced her to my mother, and she said, oh, well, it's wonderful to meet you. I mean, I've never met you before, but of course we all do feel we know you. My mother just got very serious and said, oh, I don't think I'm in any of Colm's books, you know. And I just wanted to be anywhere but there. I mean, I wanted, could God please dig me a hole now and get me out of this situation, you know. But it was a funny moment.
And do you think she is?
Aspects of her and other aspects are completely left out.
Did she say anything to you about it after?
No. Oh, no.
Almost all the stories in Mothers and Sons are about divisions between mothers and sons, whether family rifts or emotional alienation or illness or abandonment or death. I know there's not much about happy relationships and so on, but why are these characters never quite able to meet or communicate?
I think it's more interesting from a fictional point of view to find difficulty, to find conflict, to find silence, to find withholding. In other words, there's a story where a woman... Divorces in Ireland were often very messy because there was no law governing it. There were no divorce lawyers. A divorce was forbidden under the Constitution. So when marriages broke up, often there was no system of reconciliation or arbitration. So in the story called A Song, a woman just fled to England with a new man and her husband brought up the son alone, refusing the mother access. That was quite common in those situations. Now, what I'm interested in there is what would happen, it's a small island, if in one summer the son, aged 28, after 19 years, walked into a pub in the west of Ireland and someone told him that his mother was over there. What would he do? Now, there, you could give that to 10 writers and say, my colleague Maeve Binchy in Ireland, I know what Maeve would do. She'd do a wonderful reconciliation. He would go straight over to her and say, mother, and they would really meet, and they'd meet the next day and they'd talk, and you know. But I can't do that. And I just can't do it. So what I'm interested in now is the drama surrounding his not going over to her, his wanting to. And I don't even say in the story he wants to. The reader just
That's
knows
right.
he longs to. And he just moves away and away and away. And in the story as well, he's the only one of his friends who doesn't drink. And you have to guess at that. He probably doesn't drink because of a drink problem. You know, that there probably has been something. And he's quite withholding in other ways. And he just simply leaves that pub and goes out and sits on his own in the car, leaving his mother inside, having... She hasn't recognised him. But I couldn't do. If you asked me... there are no circumstances under which I could write that in which he could go up to her to say, hi, Mama, it's me. I just couldn't do it. And so you almost are controlled by certain forces in your own DNA, and your own psyche, that refuse certain endings. And that would be a very interesting subject for a psychiatrist. But it actually allows you a certain... It doesn't allow you any freedom, but it allows you to explore something quite deep within yourself that you yourself are not fully alert to, and that is controlling you, controlling the shape of your story, and maybe your life story as much as your story.
Well, that's, of course, the next
you
question.
Without being fully aware of it, you know. I mean, there were great difficulties in the years before my father died, in that he was very sick and my mother was away a lot. And it's very, no one in those years knew anything about children. I think people know more about them now. That, you know, children cannot be left confused over who's coming back or who's where. It's very disturbing. And I think that business of abandonment, which is in this book and in some of the other books, is really fundamental. But again, it's not something that we ever confronted directly. I just found it was coming into the stories and wouldn't go away. Almost like a tune that's been in your head all your life. And if you started to compose music, it would come out, you know.
You think it marked you in a way that you only discovered as a writer rather than about yourself?
That's correct, yeah.
There's something almost attractive in the sense of emptiness or isolation that some of your characters experience. I'm thinking, for instance, of your story, The Use of Reason, where... the emptiness seems to give the narrator a sense of satisfaction. I don't know if that's the kid, you coming home to the empty house and being happy, or what's that about here?
Well, I actually interviewed that man, but I mean, I became terribly interested for a while in criminals.
Why?
Just that in Ireland they seemed to me at that time that I interviewed this man, the most interesting people in the society. I wanted to know from him when I went to see him, not about his crimes, but about his childhood, what had happened, who was there, you know. And then he started to talk about it for the first time in his life. Started to say, well, you know, I was sent to juvenile detention. I said, okay, you know, what was that morning like? Who brought you to the court? And what were the first nights like? And a lot of that details in that story are things he told me. And then I added some things. But I also found, you know, that when I started to read seriously, that it was the novels of Sartre or the novels of Camus, which were very fashionable then in the, let's say, early 70s, or the novels of Kafka, really interested me. And I found them on my own. And even the early novels of Hemingway, that Hemingway male figure, slightly distant from events, describing it, in The Sun Also Rises, say. And that those books became, for me, really important books that I treasured, and they made a big difference to me. So that while I'm talking on one hand about a sort of psychological damage done, I'm talking on the other hand about a sort of literary influences that I found really interesting when I started to read, which I think matter to writers or to anyone in a way. The books you read when you're 16, 17, 18 that you find on your own tend to mark you in the way that experience can mark you, that books later on don't do in the same way.
In the story, The Use of Reason, the narrator kind of sets up a strict discipline on himself, so he doesn't have to engage emotionally with others. He's another one of the withholding guys.
Yeah, I mean, he loves his daughter and he loved his brother Billy. And that's made very clear. But he's not interested in anything else. In other words, whatever happened to him, what was this Graham Greene said, in the lost childhood of Judas, Christ was betrayed. You know, that whatever happened to him made him like that. And I left that out. I left the reader to make the reader's mind up about where he's, there's no mention of his father at all. His mother only appears in moments as a sort of hysterical figure who he's almost both repels him and attracts him, you know. I'd also never written crime. I'd never written violence. And I was walking down the street with the thing, stop not doing that. I mean, it's a great subject, violence. And there's so much of it. I probably won't ever do it again, but there's one little violent paragraph in this story that I really did just think, stop, you know, not writing that. You know, I thought I should write one violent thing in my life. So I did that.
This is when, as a young man, I mean, I'll just give the one sentence synopsis. I couldn't even ask you to read it. But as a young man, he uses pliers to remove a tooth from another kid.
Yeah, he does.
Very grisly.
I don't know how I thought it, but I was walking on the street when they came to me. I thought, I must go home and write that now.
Because otherwise he's presented as a fairly cerebral, yeah. I mean, it's called Use of Reason. I mean,
but he does blow somebody up. And he does that very carefully. And he does take pleasure in the guy having no legs afterwards. So, you know, he's a very reasonable, violent person.
Could you read from the story, The Use of Reason? And I wonder if you could just sort of set up what's happening here. The narrator, a professional thief, is looking back.
Yeah, so he's been sent to juvenile detention, and the place is called Landfad, and he's young. I mean, he's about 12, I think, at this point, and he's remembering this. His first days in Landfad were the ones which lingered most in his mind, perhaps because it was in the Midlands and he'd never been outside the city before. He was stunned by the place, by how cold and unfriendly it was, and how he would have to stay there for 3 or 4 years. He'd allowed himself to feel nothing. He never cried, and when he felt sad, he made himself think about nothing for a while. He pretended that he was nowhere. That was how he dealt with his years at Landfad. In the time he was there, he was beaten only once, and that was when the entire dormitory was taken out one by one and beaten on the hands with a strap. Usually, however, he was left alone. He kept the rules when he knew there was a danger of being caught. He realized that it was easy to slip out on a summer's night as long as you waited until everything was quiet and you choose the right companion and you did not go too far. He learned how to raid the kitchen and make sure not to do it too often in case they set a trap for him. As he thought about it now, lying back on the sofa, he realized that he had liked being on his own, standing apart from the others. Never the one caught jumping from bed to bed or locked in a fight when the brother in charge entered the room. On one of his first nights there was a fight in the dormitory. He heard it starting and then something like, "Say that again and I'll burst you." This was followed by cries of encouragement, so there had to be a fight. There was too much energy in the dormitory for something not to happen. Although it was dark, you could make out shapes and movements, and he could hear the gasping and the pushing back of beds and then the shouting from all around. He did not stir. Soon it would become his style not to move, but at this early stage he had not developed a style. He was too uncertain to do anything. Thus, when the light was turned on and one of the older brothers, Brother Walsh, arrived, he did not have to scramble back into his bed like the rest of them. But still he felt afraid as the brother loped menacingly about the dormitory. There was now an absolute silence. Brother Walsh spoke to no one, but walked around the beds, looking at each boy as though he would pounce on him. When the brother looked at him, he did not know what to do. He met his gaze and then looked away and then back again. Eventually, the The brother spoke. Who started it? Stand out who started it. No one replied. No one stood out. I'll pick two boys at random, and then they'll tell me who started it. They'll tell me, all right, and it'll be worse for you now, whoever started it, if you don't stand out. The accent was strange. He could not think what to do, except to pretend fiercely that this was not happening at all. If he were picked on, he would not know what to say. He did not know anyone's name, and he had not seen whoever it was who started the fight enough to identify him now. Also, he did not know what the rules were, if it were agreed among the boys never to tell on anyone else, no matter what. He was puzzled as to how all the rest of them had learned each other's names. It seemed impossible. As he thought about this, he looked up and saw that two boys were now standing beside their beds, their eyes cast down. One of them had the top of his pajamas torn. Right, Brother Walter said, the two of you will come with me. The brother went back to the door and turned the lights out, leaving pure silence behind. No one even whispered. He lay there and listened. The first sounds were faint, but soon he heard a shout and a cry, and then the unmistakable sound of a strap, and then nothing, and then a howl of pain. He wondered where it was happening. He thought it must be in the corridor outside the dormitory or the stairwell. Then the beating became regular, with constant crying out and yelping, and soon the sound of voices shouting no over and over. Everyone in the dormitory remained still. No one made a sound. It did not stop. Finally, when the two boys opened the door and tried to make their way to their beds in the darkness, the silence became even more intense. As they lay in bed crying and sobbing, the other boys did not make a sound. He wished he knew the names of the boys who had been punished, and he wondered if he would know them in the morning, if they would look different because of what had happened.
Colm Tobin reading from his book Mothers and Sons. There's an act of destruction planned at the end of that story, the use of reason that gives the narrator a sense of power and renewal. He seems to think he can fix his mistakes by destroying them and starting over.
Yeah, at the time I saw Martin Cahill, who this is based on, who was later shot, who's dead now, he had the paintings in the Wicklow Mountains. I knew he had them, and he knew he had them, and everyone knew he had them. It wasn't a Rembrandt, it was a Vermeer. And there are very few Vermeers in the world. And he thought it was desperately funny.
Because he'd stolen these paintings and then couldn't unload them. He couldn't sell them.
Everyone thought, people just presumed that he had great connections worldwide because he was such a great criminal. But I realized the more I saw him that he didn't. That he really was a small Dublin criminal who had just started to do very big jobs, like stealing jewels worth millions and knowing how to do bank raids, but that he didn't actually have any great connections. And certainly, I mean, if you stole a Vermeer, what would you do? So all I had to think about was, if I stole one, I really would have no idea how to proceed. And that since he wasn't stupid, you know, he was almost going to sell them to people, but then he just couldn't be sure about them. They were Dutch. And he just couldn't, he couldn't make sense of Dutchmen. And in the end, his mother, going to see his mother, gives him a sort of clarity of thought. As he goes out of her house, and she's really irritated him, he suddenly realises what he has to do, which is just simply burn them. Just simply burn them. And there's an act of nihilism. It's an act of pure destruction. And it pleases him.
It pleases him because it's an area that he can control, unlike his mum.
Yes, but it's also, it's against society. So it's doing the, you know, he has watched the news where people were talking about these as great art treasures of the world, you know, priceless objects. And he thought they were silly. He thought they were ridiculous. He had no respect for them. And therefore he burned them and he enjoyed burning them. So I thought it was interesting. I mean, nihilism is an interesting subject. It's easier to write about than joy. I mean, it's more interesting than joy for a storyteller.
There was a movie made about him, The General?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I never saw it because I thought, since I'd known him, I didn't want to see it because I knew I would do this. And I thought, either the movie will put me off writing about him or I'll steal a detail from the movie. And I didn't want to do that, you know, so this is my own version of him.
It's interesting that the act of nihilism being an act of defiance, because you have another story, The Name of the Game, where there's class conflict comes in as well, because it's a woman who you alluded to earlier who's trying to keep everything together financially for her family and succeeds by opening a chip shop, but somehow this flies in the face of the class, the townsfolk turn against her.
Yeah, I'm from a small town, and anyone from a small town in Ireland or anywhere, I think, but Ireland maybe more than anywhere else, you really are alert to class. People know where you come from, and there could be a golf club that you're not a member of, or a tennis club, or else another sort of club, or how you speak. And then there are areas of equality that are strange in a town like that, of people who've known one another for too long to be bothered not speaking to each other. But I was really using that idea that, you know, a merchant, they would, you know, like a merchant in the middle of a town could own a shop selling televisions, but try and open a fast food joint next door and you've somehow lowered the tone of the street. You know, so I was interested in that idea.
Is class still operating strongly?
Not as much now, simply because of education, but there is still a system in Irish education after the age of 12 where some kids go to schools that are really to teach them trades, and others go where they will go on to college. And that division is absolutely there. You could ask someone very easily, where were you in school? And you could actually judge what their background was. So yeah, the place is still locked into it, but not as harshly because of the amount of money the place is.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for It. Subscribe now.
Colm Tobin, your story, A Long Winter, takes place in Spain, in the Pyrenees, and you taught in Spain when you were a younger man. What made you choose Spain?
It's just as simple. Somebody told me that you could get easily a job as a teacher in Barcelona just by turning up. And I was getting ready for my finals, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Whatever way it was said, I remember exactly where I was thinking, I'm going to do that. And so I told the folks at home that I had got a job in Spain, and they believed me. I hadn't. But I did find a job very quickly.
So that part was true?
Yeah, in those days, English language teaching was not professionalised. You didn't have to do a qualification. You just turned up. People gave you work. I was 20 years old. And I stayed there for 3 years. I'd read Hemingway. I'd read George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia. I'd read Hugh Thomas's book on the Spanish Civil War. So Spain for me seemed like the most glamorous possibility. But it was much more glamorous than I imagined, and much more interesting and totally absorbing. And I had a really wonderful time there.
Because you've described it as like walking into the future.
Yeah, that it was. Franco died 2 months after I arrived, but that wasn't such an enormous change as it sounded in the way people lived. There was already great sexual freedom there. There was already great food and drink and great, you know, the colours of the Mediterranean had not been obliterated by this old dictator. But then the politics became themselves a sort of beauty. The way in which the king and Suarez organised democracy so quickly. The first elections were just the most wonderful thing to see. And to see the crowds marching into it, they were going to get what they wanted finally, which was democracy, essentially. And the night the Communist Party was legalised was a really great night there. All the old exiles flew in. Rafael Alberti, La Passionaria, they all flew in from places. Paris into Madrid airport, free at last. You know, and they ran for election and they were elected. And they weren't a majority, but nonetheless, the parliament was made up then of all the forces that had fought the Civil War, but they weren't going to fight another. It was a remarkable thing to see. It was really extraordinary. And with me, it's mixed in with other freedoms, with, you know, bars open late, with hot weather, with beautiful food, with, you know, sexual freedom, with paintings, with classical music, with all those things.
And you thought you'd never leave, but then you went back to Ireland.
Yeah, I couldn't vote. And also I couldn't find anything else to do other than teaching English as a foreign language. and it was tedious, and there was no future in it. I suppose I was ambitious, that it just, I just wasn't going to do that forever. And if you didn't go, people always said that if you didn't go after a certain time, you really had lost touch with home. It'd be very hard to go back in after. It's very hard to go home after 10 years. It's hard enough to go home after 3. But so I just went home. But I did regret it. I mean, it was very difficult to go home to Ireland, which was had no employment much. And it was before gas central heating became current, so that you came home where the only heating in most houses was an open fire or an electric fire. And waking in the morning, your nose all cold, and, you know, damp in houses. And it was bad.
Which is why you go back to the Pyrenees now.
It is, yeah, the drizzle of the Irish summer, yeah.
You also went back to Spain and to other Catholic countries in Europe to write a book called The Sign of the Cross about Catholicism there. Catholicism has been a central part of Ireland's identity. How important was religion in your home when you were growing up?
We said the rosary and did all those things, but my generation, it's a generational thing in Ireland, essentially abandoned Catholicism. I mean, people just stopped practicing it, and the parents just learned to put up with that. It's odd, though, because a lot of people who did that still want to get married in a church. People still know that funerals are held in churches, and you have friends then who start baptizing their babies. And so, you know, it's slightly gnarled. You could never fully make sense of it. And then you could go to a wedding and find two friends of yours are going up to Holy Communion. You know, when did that start? Because when I knew them, the time we talked about it, they certainly wouldn't. And so that it has an ambiguous hold, not on the society now, it doesn't have any hold on the society, but it has an ambiguous hold on people, that they're both in it and out of it at the same time, which I found very interesting.
Because you, when we talked once before, you mentioned that when you were 14, a slightly older friend told you there was no God.
Yeah. And he, you know, fed me loads of D.H. Lawrence, and he lent me those Sartre and Camus books. And I was amazed. If there was no God, but how did the world start? He said, well, it was always there. I said, oh.
So unlike you're saying, these friends of yours, you haven't returned to faith.
No, I do love a church, though.
You went to school taught by the Christian Brothers.
And then I went to school with diocesan priests. So some of that I was reading, you know, I went only for the last 2 years, so I would have arrived in a dormitory in which everyone knew everybody else already, and I would have been the only outsider in, you know. But so the last 2 years I went to diocesan school, which was very liberal, and where the priests were really, well, I mean, there was a lot of trouble later because some of them were brought to court for sexual abuse, but I never saw any of that. Instead, they were just terribly literate and terribly interested in giving us a sort of decent education.
You do take up the issue, a priest in the family considers some of the consequences of the sexual abuse scandals that the Catholic Church has gone through in Ireland. Why did you want to look at that?
My friend Andrew Hagen has written a novel called Be Near Me, which is coming out here soon, which deals with it directly. In other words, it's about one of those priests. What I wanted to do was just take that if you were a press photographer, there could be a figure in the photograph that you didn't know who it was, and it could be the priest's sister or mother. And I wanted just to look at that figure, that shadowy figure, who's something like, in a small town. What would it be like in a small town to be the mother of a priest who was up on charges of sex abuse? And just to go back to mothers, if you were an independent-minded person of great intelligence and integrity, who was living a life of, you know, great ease as an old woman, and suddenly this came to hit you, what would it be like? And partly what it would be like would be there'd be so much unsaid. No one would tell you for ages, for example. And then when they told you, they wouldn't tell you the whole story. And then I had in my head a scene where the son, who's about to go to court and will go to prison, has to drive in to see his mother. And of course, again, if you were another sort of novelist, if you were Edward Albee here, you'd have a great time now. The screaming between the two of them. Sam Shepard, you know, the mother and the son could shout at each other for an hour on stage. But I can't do that either. So for me, she just forgets she didn't put butter on the table. So she goes to the fridge and gets butter and puts it on the table and says almost nothing to him. And when she does say that she'll be here, she doesn't really mean she'll be here for him. She just, they just talk, and almost every sentence they use is code for something, but it's not clear what. But in the confrontation they have, they manage to say almost nothing to each other. And then as she goes, I thought of her at the window watching him getting into his car, where they've said nothing, and watching him being careful not to drive, not to reverse the car onto her nice lawn, because he was all such a good boy, he wouldn't do that. And that being the image, that he still will be careful in the way he's reversing the car. And nothing gets said, nothing gets finished, nothing gets completed, you know, and you just leave it at that. That the unsaid, the unspoken, is where the drama lies for me. And in that confrontation, it was very important. Everything was left hanging.
Colm Tobin, I'd like to turn for a moment to your interest in Henry James. You wrote a wonderful book called The Master, a Novel. And when did you first read James?
I read The Portrait of a Lady in the summer holidays in college. It wasn't on the course. I don't know why I read it. I was about 18. And I was really hit by the book. I thought it was a novel about style, and that morality was sort of a form of that style was a form of morality. I didn't realise it would be a plot. And I suppose I loved the prose. And then I realised there was this extraordinary plot. And I was really overwhelmed by the book. And so much so that I presumed everybody else would be too. So when I came back to college, I found that, to my dismay, that a lot of people didn't like the book and found it was just about posh people. And a great debate ensued as to whether James Joyce or Henry James was the real James. You know, people much preferring the sort of the way in which Bloom moves around Dublin and Bloom's thoughts and Bloom's wit being a more interesting thing, you know, for our time, as it were, than James. But I carried on and I read more or less everything by him. And I did, but I didn't know there was a life. I think when you're young, you can imagine that people like him could just write books out of nothing. That he just grew fat and wrote, really. You know, and it was only much later that I had to write a review, go and look up something, and thought, this is actually a very interesting story. I mean, this man, his best friend committed suicide. His cousin that he was devoted to, you know, died of tuberculosis when she was young. And then you discover the sort of strange letters he wrote, very revealing letters to younger men, which he began to write in his mid-50s. And actually, the silences are in this life are really interesting to explore. In other words, the novel form can explore silences and withholdings better than, say, could explore James Joyce running away to Trieste with Nora Barnacle. In other words, it's a well-known story. We know their emotions. They were in love and they wanted to get away and it was all wonderful. They left letters. They lusted after each other. You know, that you could... For me, that story is told. But the James story was untold in that there was so much silence surrounding it. And you could, I thought I could do it. But, you know, it was only when I started, I realised as the paragraphs were getting longer in the sentences that I was really, for the first time, sort of managing to enter into another consciousness and getting all its flickering and all its different motives surrounding moments. And I was using him very well because, I mean, I had his books all around me. I don't mean very well, but I mean that I had the books all around me if I needed help at any point. I had a letter, I had something else he wrote in that year or that month or that day sometimes. He's one of those figures we can trace him day by day. And I had nothing else to do anyway.
But were you daunted by the idea of inhabiting the mind of this master?
No, because I thought that I wouldn't in any way try and write as well as he does. I wouldn't in any way mimic his prose style, but I would just try and describe in a set of scenes things that happened to him that I thought hadn't been fully described before. But I didn't worry about the consequences.
Of how he... Imagining how he thought, what he felt.
I didn't worry about the consequences of failing or of taking on too great a project. You know, in other words, I think a novelist who might have had a much higher reputation than I did, taking on a project like that, there could be high stakes involved in failing so dismally to come up, you know, to come up with the goods about a novelist as wonderful as that. and it might look like an act of not just bravery, not just but of and not just foolishness, but of actual, you know, pure cheek. But I didn't have any of those problems, you know. I mean, I had I didn't have any great readership anywhere. It didn't really matter if the book failed.
In your novel, Henry, as you call him, keeps his feelings at a great distance from himself, careful to say nothing. How does that serve him, or how does he think it serves him as a writer?
I think it serves me more than him, in the sense that I wanted to constantly have him. He doesn't do any harm in his life, but he's very alert to anyone who might do him harm. And then he becomes harmful to people in certain ways. But that has to be constantly done around silence, around withdrawing, around just not knowing what to do or say, of standing in a room watching, of being at a window watching, or withdrawing all the time, withdrawing emotionally, but forget emotionally, just withdrawing physically, just going back to his game and realising that there's a story in that and working on the story. And, you know, simply because he lived alone, because he wasn't married, and because he didn't have, you know, a household, you can work then, you can work with solitude, you can work with silence. He's very like, perhaps too like, the character in my earlier novel, The Heather Blazing. But luckily no one much has read that book, so that no one sort of noticed that I had actually just written the same
judge.
Book twice. The Judge.
The Judge,
yeah.
I remember that, but I didn't make that connection.
But it's the same sort of figure, you know, sort of trapped in the world. Beckett went to a lecture once by Jung, where Jung said that he had a patient who was never properly born. He was biologically born, but actually spiritually or in some other way was not quite born. And Beckett, of course, took an enormous interest in this, as do I. And that business of a silent male figure watching the world, withdrawn from it, wanting something from it, yearning for something from it, but unable to go too close to it when it comes, that interests me enormously.
Was part of your interest in James also his repressed homosexual feelings, or that aspect of his character?
Yes, I think, again, it's much easier to work with repressed homosexuality than with, you know, Oscar Wilde. In other words, if you gave me a choice, write a novel about Oscar Wilde on the rampage in London, I will immediately think about his wife and two children. What was that part like? Him on the rampage. I know all that. An historian can tell me, a biographer can do that. What was it like when he came in sometimes and one of the little boys came up to him and he just, what did that look like? So that the repression, for me, seems dramatically more interesting than the having a really good time sexually, you know. And so with James, the distance he felt from his own sexuality. And the reader, of course, the modern reader especially, knowing so much more than he does. We have new names for all. I mean, you know, the gay or even, you know, like his identity becomes very clear to the reader in a way it doesn't to him. Because this is a sort of, I found a very interesting sentence about him. I think it's Alan Tate said it about him, that although he's pre-Freudian, he'd actually come to the same conclusions as Freud, more or less in the same years, without having actually formulated those conclusions. But that the idea was in the air that somehow repression and denial would in some way cause grief, difficulty or drama, and that childhood experiences darken the soul. All those things James knew.
At one point in your novel, the master, an artist, is looking at all of the wonderful books that Henry has written, and he asks him, he said, did you always know that you would write these books? Did you not say, this is what I'll do with my life? Why does that question move him to tears?
Because I went into Trinity College in Dublin once, and the students, this is recent, I mean, when I was writing this book, I just went down to do a reading, and they had all my books to sign in paperback, so they all looked the same, you know, in a row. And you don't ever see your books like that in a row, just bought new. You know, maybe there were 8 books, and I thought, oh, God, that's what I've been doing. you know, if anyone had an idea what that looked like sentence by sentence as those books were written, it would really shock them. It's the amount of the self that went into those things. But there they are in a row now. And the students were all happy, you know, we just sound, oh God, I just made a joke. I said, you know, it's like what a mother says about her children. That's what wore me out. That is what wore me out. And I remember thinking, those kids have absolutely no idea what that looks like to me. It looks oddly alien, the way they're presenting it to me. It's the distance between what that looks like, how we're conducting ourselves now, because I just signed them and got on with things. But when I saw them first, I was quite repelled by the look of them. I thought, God, I prefer if there was... that's not true to say. I prefer if there was just one. But, I mean, I hadn't ever got a sense that there was going to be a bookcase, you know, and they're going to be full of this stuff. Because it didn't... They're not written or planned like that. They're planned one by one, and they're written slowly.
So you projected some of that emotion onto
I used loads of myself in the James book, yeah. I mean, loads of just the tiny details of your day and the business of, you know, writing a bit and going to look out the window and seeing nothing and looking at it, something else. And the business of, you know, finding immense comfort sometimes in going back into work. And the business of loving to get away from everybody. And then feeling you left out of things when you are away from everything. You know, all those things. Yeah, I was using all of that.
When talking about your new book, Mothers and Sons, you said that you're interested in the subject of moral courage and how people should behave. How do you rate the Henry James of your novels?
But I'm interested in failure of moral courage. I mean, I would find it very difficult to write about a fully courageous and moral person. But it's where there are fissures in that and breaks in it. Someone who is otherwise good does something very bad. I mean, in my first novel, the woman just leaves her husband and her family and just goes.
That's in the South?
Yeah, and the rest of the book's about her. In the second novel, the judge, who actually is a very thoughtful, serious person, but he makes certain judgments that he himself does not even think are right. So I'm interested in that part of the self that under certain pressures will do something either quite dramatic or quite small that will be wrong. And what the person looks like under those pressures, having in the pressure of knowing what they've done, what the soul, in a way, because most of the novels, even some of these stories, take place over a good stretch of time. So it's almost like you can see a whole spirit being made, you know. But I'm not interested in goodness. I'm interested in something that ostensibly might look like that, but under pressure breaks.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Colm Tobin with me in Toronto in 2007. Mothers and Sons and many of his other books are available in paperback from McClelland and Stewart, who are also publishing Tobin's new novel, Long Island, a sequel to his prize-winning bestseller, Brooklyn. Today's show was produced by Mary Stinson, with thanks to Katie Swales and Olivia Pascarelli. The senior producer is Sandra Rabinovich. You can also hear Writers and Company on our website. Just go to cbc.ca/writersandcompany. I'm Eleanor Wachtel. For listeners in the Montreal area, I'll be at the Blue Metropolis International Literary Festival this coming week. On Friday evening, April 26th, Madeleine Tien will be interviewing me at a special tribute event. And on Sunday afternoon, I'll be talking to writer and illustrator Nora Krug about her latest book, Diaries of War, Two Visual Accounts from Ukraine and Russia. If you're there, come over and say hello. Next week here on Writers and Company, from the UK, poet Raymond Antrobus. His award-winning collection, The Perseverance, recounts a personal and painful history with his father, identity, and growing up deaf. That's next week. I hope you'll join me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.